Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
This upcoming concert season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas is your stop for the best in Western style. Tecovas has seasonal and limited edition offerings this spring and summer, including men's and women's boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. All Tecovas boots are made by hand in a time-honored tradition with timeless styles that are always on trend. And Tecovas has first wear comfort with little to no break-in period. It's hard to find this level of comfort paired with this level of style. Stop by your local Tecovas store, have a complimentary drink or two, that's WCB style, and shop new styles. The smell of fresh leather and friendly staff are at your service. Many stores even have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized. And with regular live music and events, there's no in-store experience like it. If you can't make it into a store, just visit tecovas.com. That's T-E-C-O-V-A-S.com. They offer free shipping on all boots, as well as free returns and exchanges, and ship right to your door. Go to tecovas.com and find your new favorite pair of boots today.
For $5 a month, you can actually see the Thin Green Line interviews and other video content on Patreon.com. Just search the Thin Green Line podcast on Patreon.com. That's Patreon.com, and feel like you're part of the conversation. Join us.
Brought to you in part by SX Sight, the fastest sight in any light, and Securit Gun Storage. Welcome back, everybody, to the Thin Green Line podcast. And today, Wayne and I are very happy to have a special guest. Annie Teal comes to us straight from the Southern California desert this morning. Annie is a 35-year veteran police dispatcher, mostly in San Bernardino County in the Inland Empire of Southern California, where, ironically, I started my career, as many of you know, way back in the 90s as a California game warden. She's an avid wilderness adventurer, trail runner, enjoys all things outdoors, very connected to the Thin Green Line, and has recently started to dive into readiness and preparedness training through firearms training. Something that stands out with Annie's career that is really exceptional and a crazy thing she had to deal with was the second largest domestic terrorist attack on American soil in Southern California on December 2nd, 2015, the IRC mass shooting incident that she was a lead dispatcher for, that she oversaw. And obviously that got a lot of appropriate national attention. That was the real reminder of some of the threats we have throughout this country that we have to be ready and prepared for. We're definitely going to talk about that. But first of all, Annie, welcome to the show. How are you this morning?
I'm very well. Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, awesome. And thanks for joining us. And I think, you know, the first thing we want to do is obviously what stands in everybody's mind, if they look you up on Google or go to the internet, right away it shoots toward the IRC incident, all your dispatchers doing a great job, you leading the charge, you going to the State of the Union address at the White House and being invited to do that after the event. And how well Washington received your whole agency and you guys on the dispatcher side. But you started loving the outdoors as a kid, going way back, right? And I know you have to have some influences, mom, dad. I think in training discussions, when you're going through pistol training, there were some discussions about your dad, especially. Take us back to the beginning and why you're such an avid outdoors woman and enjoy being out there so much.
Gosh, that's... It is fairly easy to point at my parents. They really did have a big influence on me and my siblings, and we were oftentimes outside traveling around. We did grow up mostly in California, a little bit out of the country. But for the most part, my dad had us out on his weekends. We were out not doing homework. We were out in the wilderness doing hikes, running around in the mountains, looking at rocks and streams. My dad, when we were very young, taught math and biology. And so there was a lot of that kind of stuff in and around the house. As he progressed in his career, he went on to teach outdoor education, then became a principal there. And so we had wildlife inside the house all the time. We had road injured animals that would come in to get rehabbed in the extra room that we had in the house. And there was all kinds of critters that were running around. And so it was just natural, I think, for everybody in our family to be out of doors as much as possible. And it's the best way to grow up. It really is.
For sure. You can't be doing it in the outdoors. I mean, that's great. And do you always in California, in that southern area?
So I was born in Santa Barbara, and my dad, my mom didn't work while we were growing up. They somehow managed to decide they just wanted to see the world with four kids in tow. So we grew up mostly in Northern California, spent a lot of time at high school time in Southern California. There was a little stint in American Samoa out on the island while my dad was teaching on television for the island. It was a closed circuit TV kind of a setup. And he would teach from a studio and then be broadcast out to the schools. And that was a crazy, amazing time to spend time as a little blonde kid in the middle of American Samoa with people who are not blonde. Just learning to love the Pacific and the island and everything that it had to offer. It was amazing.
Yep, I got a good friend, Owen the Samoan. So every time I hear, you know, Samoa, I think of him. And yeah, dark, big, muscular guy, for sure.
Yeah,
not like this. No, as soon as you said that, Annie, I can picture it. So definitely stood out in a crowd.
So Annie, where did you travel? Did you travel anywhere else with the family? Did you do anything locally that just changed as you got older into those teenage years and before you even started thinking about the career that we're going to talk about in a bit?
Yeah, I think that my dad and I, for whatever reason, he and I remember most often he and I together in the car just driving around and looking at the open land that was around where we were living. Oftentimes it would be the mountains of San Diego, Palomar Mountain, and Cuyamaca. And we'd go on short hikes and he would point out the different kinds of trees and plants and animals. And there was not really one specific place that we would go. He just wanted us to see the world, and it was perfect.
Fast forward a little bit to you're spending all this outdoor time. You're growing up down south, and I know, obviously, very familiar with Riverside, San Bernardino, and all the deserts out to the Arizona-Nevada border. I mean, there's a beauty out there, especially in the winter months, that I think anyone that hasn't lived or spent time out there, like on patrol like I did, don't really grasp how awesome and vast and beautiful the desert is, but how intimidating and kind of a little bit scary it is with some of the threats out there. And now you're doing some solo trail running quite a bit. And group running and whatnot. And what are some of the things you've come across, and what are things you kind of need to be prepared for when you go adventure on those type of runs?
I think if I weren't in law enforcement, I don't know that I would be as concerned about the area as I am, but I do know the trouble that can happen. There are a lot of, if you want to call them transients, unhoused, whatever the current label of the day is, right, for those folks who are living out in the desert area, because it's an easy place to survive, and it's not going to snow on you or be too horribly cold. And so running trails around here concerns me just because, as a female, you don't necessarily want to be out on your own and away from people that you can call for help. So you just have to be very, very aware of your surroundings. I have a fear, which I'm absolutely sure is unfounded, that I'll be eaten by a bear at some point. And luckily, there are no bears in this area. So I think I'll be all right.
Luckily.
Yeah. But the snakes and the stuff with stickers out there, it's about the maximum of the problems that I'm having currently.
Boy, thinking of that, you know, there's been several incidents in the recent future, for the recent, you know, right now, that runners have been attacked for sure. So, I mean, I think of several incidents across the country, the latest one in Georgia, where that girl was attacked and killed.
Tragic.
Yeah. So I can understand why, for sure. And how do you go about preparing yourself? Because I think this is a good little rabbit hole to go down sure for our female.
I think people, in particular, if you're just starting running, you don't necessarily think, oh, somebody should really know where I am when I'm going out. And if I'm going out 10 miles out into the middle of nowhere and nobody really knows, I do have one of the little mini Garmin things that I carry with me when I go out on my own. But I also let my sister know, and she's an emergency contact for me. Every time I go somewhere where I think there may be potential that nobody's going to be around me, then I do let somebody know where I'm going. You can even go down as far down that rabbit hole as you want. You can describe what you have on, what kind of food and things you're carrying with you, so that people who might need to come and rescue you know how long you will last comfortably. And then from there, where the point of direction needs to go for any kind of rescue. So it's important. I sometimes carry a knife with me. I have no idea what I would do if I needed to use it, but I do have it with me just in case. But for sure, let family know or somebody close who's in this area know where you're going to be.
So you don't run with a firearm? That's one of my questions right off, John. Sorry.
I only recently took some shooting classes, and I think the plan will be to get a concealed carry permit. Okay. I don't know that I could comfortably run with one,
right?
But I honestly I've never really considered it. So it's a new thing for me to think through, and it is a possibility. Mm-hmm. I don't have any concerns about using a gun while I'm out somewhere by myself, so it's an option.
Yeah, I know when I trail run, I know trail hike, power run, do mountains, whatever, I always have a handgun, if not a rifle, obviously, but there are a lot of small platforms like we discussed that will fit in a camelback or anything. You know, but when the mindset's there, the understanding of it, the familiarity, all those are critical. But you mentioned your little GPS device, and I think you're talking about the Garmin inReach, right?
Mm. Yeah, the mini.
Yeah, those things are a godsend. I know I'm using one, especially on solo mountain stuff, especially in Montana and the remote areas when I'm on the home front. But they really change the game because they're small, they're trackable, there's the SOS, you can text through your phone. And it really is an equalizer for those of us that wander alone. And I know all of us in this conversation do get out alone quite a bit and not in those groups. So for our listeners and viewers, if you don't have that device, the Garmin inReach is really one of the better ones, I think, that we've used in the past. But good stuff preparing. And obviously, I'm sure it's very therapeutic out there doing the runs. And that's going to transition to questions we're going to ask you later about your career. And what do you do to decompress from the career? What do Wayne and I do when, you know, we were running patrol squads, we were constantly on the go, constantly being responding to public calls, doing, you know, proactive patrols and things like that. But before we jump into that part, we got to talk about where you got to being a dispatcher. And was that something you discovered in high school or college, or knew a dispatcher? Were you on a different path, or how that?
I had it in my head when I was in high school. I wanted to be a farmer, and obviously that didn't go anywhere. Right. That's what I wanted.
In the desert.
I wanted to be outside and be working with my hands and doing something physical. And I like hard work, physical work, and that seemed to be a good direction for me. But shortly after high school, I moved up to Force Falls, which is it's a couple of mountains away from where I am now and north of here, to work at a camp for a summer. I ended up staying 5 years rather than just the summer. And in that amount of time, at the very beginning, I volunteered at the local fire department. One of the specialties of that fire department was high angle rescue. So I got some ropes training and some rescue training because of the waterfalls, and there's a huge amount of steep and very rocky trails that are up there. And so we would be called out for people who were just not familiar with the area and they need to be pulled off the side of the mountain. And it was a great experience. From that, I kind of transitioned to the potential for dispatching. I was not a fan of sitting in an office for an extended amount of time. I'm just not great at sitting around. Because of a family history of some back issues, I did have concerns about going that direction with a career. And so I just looked at the potential of being a dispatcher. And once I was in there, I was completely hooked. I love the challenge of being given a mess that you have to tidy up and then put out to the officers or whomever to respond. And that was my jam. So it seemed to work for me.
Mm. I have so much respect for dispatchers. I call them the lifeline. And in certain cases, I think too, through my career, they were my lifeline for sure. And always connected. I certainly appreciate what they do today. And the professionalism that's come along with that position, because they are first responders. As a matter of fact, when it comes to critical incident, they get it all. Whether, you know, you take in the incident you're at, well, a dispatcher takes in all the incidents. And I don't think we to let them know how valuable they are enough. And I don't think we put them on a pedestal like they should be, because they are very dynamic people and it takes a certain type of person to do that. So, and I, for one, appreciated in my shooting that a dispatch, you know, was key. Almost assaulted in West Virginia by a guy that they had just had a gunfight with in you know, the sheriffs rolled in and they're like, hey, do you know who you have here? And the only reason the sheriffs rolled in is because I wasn't responding to my radio and I could hear the radio in the cruiser and the dispatcher trying me. And then after about three times, she's like, I'm sending assistance. So, and thank goodness, you know, I could hear the cruiser. I couldn't get out on my portable, but that was that lifeline. And then when the sheriffs got there, they're like, boy, you grabbed a tiger by the tail. And yeah, we just had a shootout with his whole family, and we assume it was him, but they went out the back door in West Virginia cabin and were never apprehended. So it was only speculation that's who it was. But yeah, for that DWI that he was arrested for that day, he was already in federal prison when we had to arraign him, so it was a whole thing. But yeah, he was a very bad individual that, again, dispatchers, it would have gone a whole different way had they not been on their toes and been really good at their job. So those are two stories I will tell you that dispatchers are a lifeline. That's all I can say in all of those aspects.
Oh, I was going to say, Andy, I'm going to second what Wayne said, obviously. And we look at it from the standpoint, hey, how fast is our dispatch responding to an OIS? You know, in the six I was involved in, especially when my partner Warden was shot, which, you know, some we talked about on this podcast. We were overwhelming that dispatch center, and you guys are, I mean, you're angels, you're eyes in the sky, right? You're overwatched. And when you're juggling an OIS, an officer involved shooting, or in your case, Wayne, the assault, and when you were shot, you know, shortly out of the academy, and all the other agencies that are still having to get traffic in, and you guys got to juggle all that and then kind of, you know, fight that, stay within that eye of the storm and get through it. It's not an easy job, and not everybody is cut out for it, just like not everybody's cut out to be a law enforcement officer and be able to deal with deadly force issues. And it's amazing after sitting, one thing I like when we get new trainees coming to it, we as trainers and that new trainee go and sit with three or four different dispatchers on several different days. That's something Cal Fish and Game was requiring. I thought it was great. It was kind of like going to dispatcher FTO school, where you get to see the personalities of each dispatcher, how they do things maybe a little bit differently, but stay with the protocol. And right then, Wayne, you know, we get that young officer going, oh my gosh, look at all that communication and all that tech. And there's five things up on this slow screen. And then there's this going on with the PD. And they're like, I don't want to do that. That's crazy.
But it's a talent.
And you're right there for us when we call. And some days are worse than others, right, Annie? And I think you, to going through your career, you did a lot of work before the incident we're going to talk about that was really kind of the pinnacle of what I would say stressful, where efficiency and speed was critical, where critical thinking and not overreacting and responding appropriately was really critical because of what was happening. And take us through just your first years of learning the job. How tough was it? When did you become a leader? What was it like to run your team? And thankfully, you had a really good team on that day.
I had an amazing team on that day, an amazing team. I started dispatching in 1987 before there were really computers that were involved in the process. Mm-hmm. We did all of our call taking with pen and paper. The extent of the technology was a little slot that you would slide the card into and the light would turn green or red regarding which way the officer was going. It was either green or red, and that was it. And so that job has progressed to what it is now, where the potential, I mean, the extreme right now, the debate that's going on is whether or not dispatchers should be accepting video calls from people and seeing what the callers are trying to explain, seeing that in person and being able to reiterate that into the text of a call. And there is a lot of debate around that, whether that would be good for dispatchers or not good for dispatchers, or even really helpful for officers to respond to. But the huge range of growth in technology and communication that has taken place in that amount of time has been pretty amazing. And to understand the value of working with a complex team, I think, and because the majority of my coworkers or my subordinates were female, there's a whole different dynamic that comes into play about how to best direct and or supervise female employees who are the same as you, who think things differently than a male employee may do. And so you really got to be aware of so many different variables as a dispatcher and a supervisor.
How many years did you work just in the seat as a dispatcher before you became a team lead and a supervisor?
Well, as a supervisor in all but one of the agencies, I worked at five different agencies.
Okay.
Not counting the one that I went to Portland, Maine for, but all of those supervisorial positions were floor supervisors. So we actually did the job at the same time as supervising the dispatchers who were under us. Mm-hmm. So I spent that entire 35 years on a radio.
Wow. Wow. That's a long time.
Which I'm not going to complain about. Don't get me wrong. I like it.
Yeah. And your skill set, I'm sure, improved and built, and just the technology, like you said. And I think you gave me like a little frightening when I talk about the video calling too. And I can see nothing good coming out of that, to be honest with you. I think we've got a pretty good system, yeah. But I mean, I don't know. You guys have to deal with so much. Why add that actual visual trauma to your job? I can't imagine putting that on top of everything else.
One of the things that I can see would benefit is if the caller is not able to speak or not able to communicate anything and all you have is a video, then you can at least describe what it is that's in your view. But beyond that, I don't know that it would be helpful.
That's interesting. So you just, like you said, with technology jumping up, that never even came into my thought that we might be dispatching or be via video calls and things like that. But it's here, it's happening. And yeah, have you ever had experience with that?
I have not. Okay. So far, there's too much pushback from dispatch crews who don't want that in their line.
I can see why.
I definitely get it. There's a kind of an offshoot or a precursor to that is a technology that is actually in play. I know there are a couple agencies, at least down in San Diego County, who use, I can't think of the name of it, but it enables an officer to listen to the 911 call that's coming in while they're driving to a call so that they can hear the tone of voice of the caller, or they can hear specific things that maybe the dispatcher didn't put in the text of a call. And I'm on the fence about that one as well. Mm. Because there's something called priming an officer or priming a situation where a dispatcher can word things in a particular way within the narrative of an incident. And it sets an officer in one direction, no fault of his own. It's just the way he reads or interprets what he's reading. There's just an awful lot to think about. And so sometimes it gets to be so much, you just have to go back to the basics and say, it's just the facts. Just put the facts in there.
Right. Because there's a comm in a dispatcher. So you're almost the interpreter from that call.
Right.
And yeah, and that's the beautiful thing about having a dispatcher is that, you know, you never get that, and maybe you do in the voice sometimes when it's an extreme call, you know, it affects you guys as well, and you can tell the urgency, but I can think through my years, and it was always the calmness, the professionalism of that dispatcher, like you said, sets the stage for the officer responding.
Yeah, they do.
Yeah.
It's an important thing to note that sometimes newer dispatchers just don't quite get.
Mm. And that whole part of that training is got to be difficult to bring them into that as well. And I bet you watch a lot of dispatchers because...
Yeah, unfortunately.
It's a different job when you go to sit there and actually listen to call after call or respond to call after call. Yeah, they always... John, I don't know if you guys have to do the same. We had to do a stint in our dispatch center. And I hated every second of it.
Yeah. Almost every officer says exactly that.
Yeah.
It is different. I think that we often will get injured officers come in and set in dispatch when they're trying to recover and they're not allowed to be back out in patrol. So we'll put a headset on them and say, here's the buttons you push. And the majority of them will make the effort, and the vast majority will get up after 2 or 3 weeks, or they'll be instantly recovered and say, I'm going back out.
Good, I'm good to go. That back feels good.
Yep. The chief that did that was smart, huh?
Yeah. It's like you said earlier, I think there are certain people who can do the job, and there are those who just aren't made for it. And it's not a judgment on anybody. It's just a way your mind works. And if you can coordinate the information coming in into something that's useful going out, then that's what you can do.
Mm.
Yeah, definitely. And since you worked in large populated areas, the Inland Empire, I'm thinking about specifically, and I'm thinking about when I was there from 92 to 95 operationally, I always tell people in stories when they talk about, well, what was your career path? Where did you find the biggest challenges? And I went from the Silicon Valley and got thrown right into Southern California. The only thing I knew about Southern California was where Disneyland was. And when my captain said, okay, Mr. Norris, you're going to Lake Elsinore. And I thought he said Lake Elmanor. And Wayne, if you don't know, Lake Elmanor is a pristine lake in our Northern California on the near the Oregon border. It's more like the High Sierras or like your White Mountains. I'm like, no way, fresh out of the gate, I'm going to Mount District. He's like, no, Norris, you misunderstood me. Elsinore, and I'm looking it up, and all these state park lifeguards that were from Southern California in our academy to lateral over to Fish and Game, they're looking at me going, whoa, like, whoa, you're in for it. I'm like, what is going on? Place was, the nickname was Lake Elsinore, at Elsinore. I didn't know anything about how crazy the Inland Empire was with methamphetamine, with gang members coming over the hill, the spotlight with AK-47s, and how many officer-involved shootings were going on in meth labs that San Bernardino sheriffs were raiding in Riverside and the PD, and the Christopher Dorner incident happened down there like way after I left. And so for our listeners and viewers, and Wayne, people got to know, Annie was in, she was in the fray. I mean, that is a place that, and I know, and Annie, a lot of dispatchers I worked with up here in the Bay Area, primarily through the majority of my career, they call it those, I don't know what you guys call it. I think you have a term for it, but you're looking for those, when it, we call it getting Western on the Met team, when things are going to get Western or going to go loud, and maybe there's going to be something really aggressive and heaven forbid some gunfire. But you guys like those exciting calls, right? That's like the big test. Like, is there a chase? Is it a code 3 pursuit? Did it lead to a gunfight? Was there a canine deployment? And you're in the mix just like the officers. And I know our dispatchers had it a lot less than you guys do down there, because I can honestly say the learning curve down there for 3 years was equivalent to 10 or 15 years in Northern California, because of the dangerous calls, because of the need for backup. And I was on the radio more down there than I think I was the rest of my career until Met Operations, just because it was so crazy. So you worked in a dangerous area. You were active. Your people that, you know, the rest of your team were very, very active. And before the IRC incident, we're going to talk about in detail, because that really is the pinnacle. Give us a, you know, kind of a template of what your routine week was, or quasi-routine week of those dangerous calls coupled with the calls for service that are pretty sedate. And how do you feel and flow and adjust with that, especially as a new dispatcher?
Well, I guess it helps to kind of give an overview of training for City of San Bernardino, at least when I was there 7 or 8 years ago. You would start as a trainee on phones, and so you didn't even touch the radio. All you do is figure out how to take a phone call, how to speak to the public, how to get information out of them. And you'd start with administrative lines, not 911. And so you'd take calls about loose animals in the street or burglaries that happened, and they're cold calls, so there's nothing happening as the call is coming in. Alarm calls that are just very straightforward. And so you get the basics down. And this, I kind of, it's a theme that runs not only through my life, but in dispatching in particular, is know your basics, get the basics absolutely solid. And so once a dispatcher has that base, they can move forward from there. From admin lines, then you move into 911 calls, and you kind of get people who get a little jiggy on the phone, and they may or may not give you the information that you're looking for, and you need to figure out how to talk to them. And you can't talk to them like you just graduated from college and you've got, you know, much learned language, and you have to actually talk to them in a way that they're going to understand you. And you have to take it and funnel that down through professionalism. How are you going to talk to somebody who's just off the hook about their brother getting shot or something without sounding like you are so cold and uncaring because of the way that you're speaking? So it's just, that's part of the learning process. Once you get done with phones, then you move into radio. You'll start on the backup channel or channel two, which is administrative channel, run for driver's license or for warrants or for making phone calls for tow trucks, just easy stuff. And then once you're comfortable there, then you get put in the hot seat and you can get whatever is thrown at you. I have to say, after having been away from that city for, it's been almost 8 years now, and then going back into it, I felt like a freaking baby giraffe. I was all over the place. And it was, it's working radio where I used to be able to do it with my eyes closed, and coming back now as a, I'll call myself an older person, quasi-retired, it's a tough seat to sit in, and it's taken a lot of mental gymnastics to get comfortable there again. And I can't say I'm 100%. So there is a learning process that happens. And so they don't just dump you on the radio and say, all right, have a good time. Here's a Kevlar helmet if you need it. You know?
Good luck.
Yeah.
Everybody alive today. Don't.
Yes, there is a process. So, and it really does stand on the basics. You have to get the basics down. Know your geography, know your resources, and know your equipment.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, let's go back. So you were retired and then kind of going into phase two that wasn't going to involve being a dispatcher. And just recently now, after 8 years, you go back when things have even escalated more in your absence. And so you are learning again and you are jumping back in. And you're not supervising a team now, but you're around a lot of other dispatchers, maybe that you work with before, maybe new ones you can still mentor and then catch up and kind of do a refresher yourself. How's that going overall? That's a big jump again.
It is a big jump. I would rate myself about a B minus. There's a lot to learn. And it's not so much things that I haven't known in the past, but it's more how to be confident and reapply what I know happens. Yeah. As an example, just yesterday I got kicked in the teeth because I got an address wrong and put in a man with a gun call where a guy was in the street waving around two guns. And I got 8 officers going. There was a helicopter coming. I had the address right. I had looked at it, double checked it, had the RP on the phone. Okay. She was hiding in her car because the guy was standing out in front of her Suburban. And turns out it was in Colton. It was not in San Bernardino. And I had gotten the address, the city, all wrong. I was like, oh, man, I'm so new.
Little gap between the two for sure, right?
Yeah.
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 It's a learning thing. But it's the process is easy for those to whom the job comes naturally. And we have a handful of guys who are currently in their dispatching. For whatever reason, I think they're able to manage the social, cultural communication between us and the community maybe a little better, and then adding technology on top of that. Mm-hmm. Just from what I'm looking at in the last couple of months, it looks like the guys can more quickly pick that up than the girls. But it really has a lot to do with your own personal experience and what you're bringing to the table. You cannot be somebody who has no world experience and come in and expect to make it an easy job. It's just not that way.
Yeah, for sure. And you mentioned the the male to female ratio. I remember up until I retired, you might have had one man in the dispatch center.
Yeah.
Maybe two at the most out of like 10 that we would work with, say, out of the Monterey area for this, particular part of California. So it's good to see guys getting involved and mixing it.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, they're doing very well.
Yeah, I think we had about a 50-50 ratio.
Really?
Much. Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah, cool. No, there's two guys that were out of my dispatcher, actually both brothers, and they do an outstanding job. Yeah, so they've been careers. And a lot of them start off, it's a great place to start off for police officers. To get in there as a part-time position, you're learning the lingo, you're learning the procedure, and it's a good stepping stone. And a lot of our police officers went that route, so that's always a good stepping stone for that. And I always encourage people to do that if you got some time and you need a job, and it's a good job, it's a well-paying job, and it gives you some like you said, life experiences that you're probably not going to get anywhere else. Like I said, it wasn't for me. I step inside that. I wanted to run after. So, but for some of those guys, it was a perfect way to segue into law enforcement.
That's good. Mm.
Yeah, but if we weren't going to sit in the seat and stay in the dispatch center, Wayne, I don't know about you, but I was with or without a partner, with or without a trainee, I was bringing in chocolates, I was bringing goodies, because I'm like, oh my gosh, I have like worth these ladies like so much on calls. Just send them back the gratitude, because you guys really save our bacon a lot.
No doubt.
Impress a lot of other agencies, but let's talk about December 2nd, Annie, 2015. That was even a big hit because I was running our MET unit in only our second year of operations, and we were in Northern California doing some cartel ops in the woods, and we were hearing this thing coming in on news feeds and actually hearing other officers talking, getting wind of this through their agencies that San Bernardino was in they were in a shit show. It was a firestorm down there.
Yeah.
Unprecedented attack. Like we said in the intro, the second largest mass shooting that was a terrorist-related planned attack in America since the 9/11 Twin Towers, and that's significant that it happened to happen right in your city. And I think there were, if I remember, 14 fatalities and 22 yeah. plus injuries, and then a couple officers injured, thankfully not fatally, during a shootout that kind of ended the ordeal. But take us through how that happened and what you guys started with the information you were given, and then coordinating that IC system so effectively for as many officers responded, and how dangerous it got.
It got extremely dangerous. The IRC is the Inland Regional Center, and it's a building, a property that has, I think it was three different buildings on it. And at that time, on that particular day, the health department, the health department covers a number of different things. They don't just go out and do inspections, but they were holding a training and then planning on having a Christmas party thereafter. And so they were in one of the larger areas of one of the buildings to have their gathering and their training. And it was a fairly slow morning. We were very short staffed in dispatch as usual, and it was pretty quiet. The initial call that we got was not somebody who was on the property. It was someone who lived in the area and had heard the gunshots and reported them. We thought maybe it was people who were shooting in the flood control channel that was behind that particular property. But shortly thereafter, within a few seconds, we got calls from people who were in the building and started to describe what all was going on. I was the supervisor on that day, but I also happened to be working the primary radio, which may or may not have been a good thing. As a supervisor, you really don't want to have your feet in the middle of everything right. going on, because you don't get a good perspective. But that being said, had I not been on the radio, I would have been neck deep in phone calls and not been able to supervise either. So I might have been in the better place to make decisions as a supervisor. But within, I would say, 30 seconds, maybe 45 seconds, one of the dispatchers stood up across a barrier that we had between each of the consoles and said, "This is an active shooter." And I looked at her in the eyes and I said, "Okay, let's do this then." Because we hadn't had very specific training about how to handle an incident like this from a dispatch perspective. Most of the trainings that happened were for patrol or for administration on how to manage something like that. But very rarely were dispatchers involved in any kind of training like that. That's certainly changed from that point forward. There's a lot of training out there now for that. So if dispatchers out there haven't had that kind of training, I would definitely encourage them to at least go experience and get some perspective. But once that statement was made in dispatch, we had the guys that I sent initially to go check the call were a sergeant, a detective who was in on overtime, who hadn't worked the field in many, many months. I might even say a couple years. There was a motor officer with a little bobblehead helmet that he was going down there, and that was all I had. And so none of them really went into the incident prepared in a way that they might have been had they come from a regular patrol unit or from a training where they were prepared for something like that. Additionally, we had our SWAT team was on the opposite end of town, on the north end of town, doing a training for active shooters. It just happened to be coincidentally on that same day. So they were all, as a team, they were already gathered up in a group. Once they heard what was going on, the lieutenant got on the radio and said, "We're on the way." They changed out all their weapons on the way down there. They had all the equipment that they needed because they were using it for training. And they were there shortly thereafter. And I think there were so many things that happened that people would say were coincidence, but we would not have been so successful as an agency had things not happened the way that they did. And people, I think, in the field had been trained enough to know, okay, we're going to gather up in a group of three or four guys. We're going to go in and here's what we're going to do. And there was no question about what they had. They didn't stop and check, okay, are you going to do this? Or they just went in and did it. And it seemed very, from our perspective, seemed to work quite well. Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. It just one thing I thought about, you guys kind of had to play a little bit behind the curveball, because for our listeners, this was an actual employee that was married to, had a spouse that had radicalized together for jihadists. And he was at that function, or could have been at that function, for the party, for the training. And so they were already embedded. It wasn't like, you know, a group of terrorists stormed the door and you guys had a lot of notice. They were literally embedded with people at the party, with people at the training, and then out come the ARs and the pistols, and they just started, you know, going to deadly work. So the fatalities were quick. As we look back on the incident, obviously I remember it from when it happened, but never dissected it until we got prepared to talk to you about it. And so I think you guys had a speed challenge, just because they had an embedded presence already. They were already very familiar with the interior. They knew how to escape. They knew how to navigate. They had pipe bombs. They had a ton of ammunition, and they were prepared. They were very, very well prepared. It had been planned, I believe, for a couple of years from reading some of the DOJ reports and how they got the ARs from a relative and things like that. So great that your SWAT team was training active shooters and were close. That kind of equalized the curve a little bit to speed up with the embedded advantage they had. But now you're playing with the aftermath of that initial assault, and what keeps happening from that point?
Well, this is where I think not enough attention was given to the dispatchers who were working the phones on that day, because they really took the brunt of the reality of the situation. They had people calling in who had been shot. They were people who were literally dying on the phone while they were talking to them. They could hear all the commotion that was going on in the background. And I feel like not enough kudos was given to them, because they did an amazing, outstanding job. They really did. And I keep telling people, I was just the 10-4 girl. You know, they all did the work all behind me. I just took the information that they gave and went forward with it. And they really did all the hard work. We had folks that were describing the suspects. There was enough information that was getting out, and that they had left in an SUV. Mm-hmm. There was enough information getting out that the guys in the field could react to that fairly quickly. There was an intel analyst from the narcotics division who did some very quick work to figure out, once the plate was given about the SUV, she did a little back work and figured out it was a rental and that it was registered or had been rented by a guy who had been at the party, and he was named. So we knew who it was. We had a couple of teams that went over to the city of Redlands, which was right next door to the apartment where they live. And as they were headed that way, sounds like the SUV went by them. So the narcotics guys flipped around, started following it, flagged down one of the Redlands sergeants, the Redlands PD sergeants, to have him do a traffic stop or to follow up on that. And then that kind of, they were headed back to San Bernardino. So they got to the south-south end of San Bernardino, and that's when the final shootout happened.
So the time frame between all of that was fairly quick, considering what you guys had. Was it was under an hour, right? Or
It was close to maybe a couple hours. I don't remember exactly the timeline yet. It was not long at all.
Yeah, that's amazing. And I know I have to ask you from a coordination standpoint, because of the OISs I've been either involved in directly or responded to with officers or some of my guys that were involved. I will never forget walking out of a site we were involved in our first OIS when our partner was shot in a cartel grow, and where our patrol trucks were parked at a gate on an edge of a mountainside. And then when we are walking to the trucks thinking we need to go now because there's going to be interviews, there's going to be debriefs, there's going to be hospital. And there were like 100 cars from different agencies stacked up behind our vehicles. There was no way, unless we had a crane helicopter and a PAFOC was going to lift us out of there. I went, I got to get out of here. I got to move my people. And here's all these locked up cars from sheriffs, from San Jose PD, canine units, SUVs, like 10 different agencies. And I'm stuck. You know, someone have a motorcycle, a mountain bike, you know, a unicycle, something. I got to just start pedaling and get out of here. So did you guys have any problem with that from the standpoint of everybody just plugging the funnel and not having any ingress and egress? Because I know we did a lot of training after that with Barry, SWAT teams, and coordination on mutual aid and standards in our operations plan of, this is how you get through. This is areas you got to consider. Go to this gate, keep it unlocked, flag it so, you know, vehicles can get through. It was a real problem and a lot of incidences, until everybody from an allied agency standpoint, especially being so close to the Bay Area and the Silicon Valley and big agencies like you're dealing with down there, before people really started to realize, hey, it can get weird in the urban situation, but put a game warden truck up against a gate and all these other cars can get right behind it on pavement, and now you've got basically a massive traffic jam.
Yeah, I think the Dorner incident, actually, where some of our folks were involved, was the first time that really became problematic, when so many different agencies were responding because they wanted to help. In that particular incident, was a toughie. And I think because of the parking situation, then the IRC incident was only slightly better than that one was, but I think they at least had it in their mind. One of the strange things that happened on that day was the, because at that time the radios were not, they were still available to the public. And so at the same time that things were happening in dispatch, we had a TV that was on 24/7 in the dispatch center. And so the news coverage is happening at the same time. So we were seeing what the guys were seeing out in the field, and had an overhead perspective. And you could definitely see from some of the news coverage, there was major problems with traffic by the final, the shootout at the end. There was significant travel or problems with parking. And gosh, they must have had over 100 cars that were stacked up in there and trying to get out. Even getting ambulances in was a toughie.
That was my next question, was the trauma response and those delays, especially because there were some people that did die. They weren't dead yet. There were some people severely injured that were on the fringe in reading some of the reports. And it sounds like overall it went pretty smoothly, but were there any delays there that led to some changes? And we're not nitpicking anybody, but just looking at the Monday morning aspect of it and lessons learned. And I mean, sure, we'll get into the dispatch center and what you guys went through as an after action report, what, you know, your crew had to deal with from stress trauma to what are we going to do differently? Cause you didn't have a lot of that. Like you said, that just was not, there wasn't a lot of training going on yet.
Yeah, there wasn't. I don't know if specifically any changes were made from there. I haven't been told anything like that. I do know that there were tactical paramedics that had just started being used prior to the IRC, and they were integral in going, they teamed up with some of the police guys and went through the building at the very, very initiation of the incident.
Excellent.
Yeah, and they were very helpful to have on site. And same with the end of the incident. They were a really important part of that response.
Yeah, that's something to highlight a little bit, because that was about the time, I remember when we started the MET team in 2013, trauma medics were usually in landing zones, or they were, you know, surgeons that were gonna come into the scene that were on quick call. And you didn't technically have normally a tactical operator in there operating. And that was something we eventually got 2 or 3 years into our MET unit, when we could recruit a Southern California young officer that was paramedic trained, advanced paramedics, Delta level medic, some of those skill sets coming from special forces in the military. And SWAT units were just starting to do that right around that incident in 2015. Yeah. 'Cause I know 2013, we still didn't have that on our team. And it was kind of like, you know, an act of, the good man above to get that. And so now that's kind of, most big agencies have it. Most smaller agencies can borrow from that team to get that yep. trauma response in there. And I know I'm speaking to the choir with the three of us, but having that trauma medic going in initially is literally a life-saving difference with seconds. Yep. And telling us as operators that know pretty good trauma medicine from the standpoint of a layman, but this is what we're going to triage. This is what you need to get going with tourniquets. This is what you have to do if you have a sucking chest wound from a gunfight, if you have just trauma stress, how to isolate that person, calm them down, blah, blah, blah. And it was neat to see that starting to happen. And I know it had gone a little bit slower a lot before that on many instances. But
yeah.
When this thing all resolved, how did it resolve, for one, from your guys, from the standpoint of the dispatch center, of moving units out? Obviously, you had to, I'm sure you were talking to commanders overseeing the tactical operations. And I think I read in one report, there was one particular sergeant, lieutenant, captain, or commander that did a really, really good job of understood the IC command system, which, again, that was kind of a new thing that not a lot of agencies were putting a lot of people through, except tactical leaders. And then it went over to patrol because of active shooter, because of the post 9/11. What happened with that? Because there were some really good things that happened reading the DOJ yes. after action, if you could mention that.
Yeah, that there was Lieutenant Travis Walker was the guy who had been trained in the IC system. Mm-hmm. And that's typically more of a fire entity or a use. And I think it has just very slowly kind of rolled over into law enforcement. And I wouldn't say it's even in place as much as it should be now. It could be used more so. But I think a lot of the police training is sort of mirrored after an IC system. They may not call it that, but it's very similar, where you have a break, you have command staff, you have a breakdown from that of who's doing what to whom. And if Lieutenant Walker had not been out there, I don't think it would have been as smooth as it had been. He was actually the lieutenant who was with SWAT, and they were doing their SWAT training. So when he came down, he let his SWAT guys go, and he instantly set up the IC at a particular place, and he was assigning tasks to people. And it was such a relief for me, at least as a dispatcher, to be able to raise him and say, I need this and that. And he said, okay, I got this. And to know that he knew what he was doing and why I was asking these questions, to have that in place was, it would not have gone well without it. It really wouldn't have.
Yeah. Another blessing of the day. Thank heaven for Lieutenant. That's awesome.
Yeah.
That way. And then again, the nice thing is that it was effective. That was a national case, and there were so many DOJ tactical write-ups, and there were lessons learned and things that did seem to implement in many years. I know we read about it tactically when we got our team built, and then it was quite a refresher preparing to talk to you about it. It was kind of nice to go back even deeper, looking at all that. But now we're dealing with you guys, your team. We're getting to the end of the incident. Obviously, you're probably having some feedback from LE operator commanders, whatever the case may be, your administration. How was the overall vibe with your dispatchers? What did you guys discuss? What you can share? What was the mindset, the morale, you know, just the vibe after going through something that crazy for anybody, regardless of years of experience on?
Yeah, I think initially the vibe was very good. I think we all knew that we had done the job as well as we possibly could. It was an enormous amount of phone calls for them to be taking in for as short-staffed as we were. That being said, very shortly after it all started, people started coming in and out of the woodwork, and people would come in from home who they lived a few blocks away, and they come, hey, can I help? And there were officers who were on light duty who just wandered in and said, hey, let me answer some phone calls. And without them, we would have been lost. But then that, as a supervisor, then you got to start thinking, well, in 3 days from now, who am I going to have left for staffing? I mean, am I going to work my people 20 plus hours because they came in and volunteered to do this? You have to think about staffing. You have to think about so many things as a supervisor in an incident like that. For example, at the very beginning, I knew our CAD system did not function particularly well when it was overloaded and it would freeze up and die. And I thought, that's the last thing we needed.
There you go. We're going to flood those gates today.
So one of the first things that I asked one of the girls to do was to call the head of IT and have him come and sit in one of our supervisor offices and manage the CAD system to make sure that it was going to continue to work well. And I think that was a good decision. They stayed for quite some time, almost the entire incident, just to make sure that our technology was going to be able to support the incident itself. Mm. And I think towards the end of the incident, you could tell dispatchers were sort of getting a little tired. And so I made sure people were doing okay. I tried to make eye contact with everybody and say, can you go take a break and walk around? We had one little trainee who ended up staying with the department. I'm a little surprised that she managed it, but she did stay, and she did an amazing job as a dispatcher. But as a trainee, my concern was, I don't want her to get lost in this disaster and not learn something from it. So I made sure somebody had an eye on her all the time, that she was given something to do so that she could learn while she was doing it. And there's just a lot to think about. So afterwards, I think my concern was for everybody's emotional health. And so I checked in with those that I could. I think some of them handled it better than others. Of the folks that started out that morning, there were four dispatchers there, and two of the four are still there in place. And then myself, one of them left the department. Another one went to be a lawyer. The trainee did six more years, and she's now teaching at an academy. And
nice.
Yeah. And I think people handled it the best that they could. Towards the end of the day, we had a counseling team that was placed in dispatch. I think that was a learning experience. It's a little awkward to have counselors coming in. And if you feel like you're not going to be able to manage something, it's even more awkward to stand up and say, hey, can you help me? And what to like to meet with them in front of everybody else is just not well thought out.
Right, right.
Yeah. So I think there were some internal lessons that were learned on that day that I think could have been done better.
No, it's good stuff. Did you have anybody that just realized this is too much for me? You know, a little bit of PTSD action going on, and I'm going to, you know, not do this job anymore, because it happens with a lot of LEOs, if you know that pistol or rifle or carbine has to be deployed or an officer gets shot, we see that. And I know we had, when my partner was shot near fatally on that cartel grow op in August 5th of 2005 up here, we were coordinating with the Santa Clara County Sheriff's Dispatch. But I, as a team leader for my unit of game wardens, was talking to that dispatcher directly on miscommunication, delayed air response for a rescue. And some of those dispatchers either left the job or took quite a bit of time off just to recover and go through like what we would as officers with that administrative leave, that mandatory counselor visit, more if you need it. Are you guys offered that service that you can see counselors?
Yes.
How'd that go for everybody afterwards?
I think today it's way more acceptable to take advantage of that. The city provides a counseling team. It's anonymous. You can go in and talk to anybody at any time of the day. You can come and talk to your supervisor and say, I'm having a tough time. The supervisor's job is to say, let's get you some support somewhere. Now, because it's so much more acceptable, I think it's more effective. Back then in 2015, it was less acceptable to go and choose that. And so I don't know. I feel a little bit like the department didn't insist on people getting counseling or some sort of support afterwards as well as they could have. They made it not mandatory. It was an option if you wanted to, and most people just kind of shrugged and said, I'll just go to work tomorrow, it'll be fine. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
which perhaps it's the norm back then. Now it's a little more acceptable, and I think that's positive.
Yeah, and I've always found with counselors, if they don't know what you do for a job, you know, you kind of write them off in the first 30 seconds. And
you have that conversation.
Yeah. And I think we've been a little more sensitive to that now. And as far as dispatch goes, I think, you know, we consider you first responders. I think when I first came on, dispatchers were dispatchers. They weren't first responders. And that has changed. And it's changed. And like I said, you guys get more of the crap than all of us put together because it's continuous. You know, it's we have an incident, or maybe a police incident, but then there's a fire incident, there's an EMS incident, and it is constant. And that's why when you talked about a telephone call, I'm like, that's just what you need, is to see what you're doing. And I'm thinking the same thing for me. You know, I got to deal when I get there. I don't need to see what's going on until I get there.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, that's exactly right. It's a lot sometimes.
Hmm.
The good thing is that, I mean, it's not like we have to, for the most part, at least at San Bernardino, we don't have to write reports as dispatchers. And so at the end of our shift, you unplug and you go home, and that's that. You don't have reports hanging over you.
You are constantly writing reports. That is every little thing that comes in. You are typing like crazy and you're doing this. Yeah. I think I'll take up the reports from that. I mean, carpal tunnel every time I see a dispatcher working. I'm like, you know.
court reporter on steroids. Never stop and take a break. The hands are freezing up. The knuckles hurt.
Yeah.
And Annie, when this incident wrapped up, one of the first things we researched about your background is when you go and look you up on the internet, it's State of the Union, dispatcher gets invited with officials from police department to Obama State, blah, blah, blah. So to me, automatically, that was like a total kudu and a total win, because now dispatchers are included and they're getting recognized as what you just said, brother. These are first responders. These are angels or oversight, right? They're guiding, they're kind of driving the bus to save as many lives as possible. So, and I think, I don't know of any other dispatchers that I've ever worked with that have gone to Washington, D.C. to a State of the Union. What was that experience like? And you were able to represent on behalf of your team in the interviews where you discuss it, you talk your team up, which is beautiful, you know, no I in team, was really cool to see. But you were there with police chiefs. You were there with other officials, other politicians, attorneys, things like that. Walk us through that and how significant that was just for law enforcement in general with the good job San Bernardino did, but you guys as dispatchers being the first up.
I don't have enough words to be able to say how much of an honor it was to be asked to go there and represent what we did and who we are as dispatchers. It really was an honor. I am not political at all. I don't like to be involved in political stuff. Going to the White House and being able to view the State of the Union was amazing. It was literally beyond words. I will cherish it forever. I was given an opportunity to speak to several news organizations about the incident and about the trip to Washington. And it's I can't say enough good things about it. It was educational and it was motivational and it was a good time all around.
Yeah, well, you crushed it out there in Washington. And again, the headlines say, Dispatcher, Inland Empire, this incident at the State of the Union. And I think, and like we're talking about, you know, everybody needs to realize exactly what you guys do, due credit as well, but understand the difference between a dispatcher and a first responder and being an integral part of that team. So that was really, really cool to see. And something we always talk about, and something that came up really kind of the origin of this podcast, the Thin Green Line podcast that Wayne and I started up on top of Warden's Watch, right, Wayne, in the middle of COVID, mm-hmm. during lockdowns. So what was happening during lockdowns? People were depressed. There was abuse of alcohol and drugs. There was depression because of lockdowns, and nobody could get outside. Nobody could breathe fresh air, especially in those city areas. So, you know, my saying to my family and my dad that I carry is my mantra is the woods are my church. Mm-hmm. There's spiritual enlightenment out there. You can be having the worst day, relationship trauma, bad day at work, big mistakes that you stepped on it again and made a big mistake or whatever, but we can always get a little bit of strength out in nature. And you do that, enjoying your runs in the desert, which has a calming effect anyway. How therapeutic, how essential has that been? I mean, back then with whatever you were doing in the outdoors and now maybe in retirement, I'm being presumptuous, but assuming you're getting a little more time to play on those trail runs and explore with that severe mapping stuff you're doing. Does that play a role? Do you find it as a real benefit? Has it been good for you and some other people that you run and trail walk with as well?
Yeah, it's a necessity for me. And I try and encourage my dispatchers or the folks that I'm working with now to do something outside every day if you can manage it. I have always been sort of a solo runner. I didn't really like running with groups. I don't like large crowds to begin with. And so I don't want to be, if I'm going to go outside, I want to be by myself and in nature. I don't want to be chatting about, particularly about work. I don't want to talk about work, but I would rather just be quiet. And the one exception to that was actually with a dispatcher. She was a younger dispatcher and was on my shift and had been a runner. And she and I said, okay, let's go try a run together. And she ended up being a running partner of mine for six, seven years at least. Yeah. And she's still at San Bernardino. So when I return and I'm currently running and she's not running, so I'm going to try and drag her butt back out on the trail and see if I can get her back where she needs to be. She is now a supervisor. And I think is having some of the same stressors that I had back at that time where I found running and being outside or on a trail, doing anything outside really was beneficial to me in a big way. And I think that's, what I really appreciate about you guys is that you're making it, I guess, more out in public about what's good about nature and why we need to get out there and why we need to have rules and regulations about it and people adhering to those rules. And it's really been a good education for me to listen to you guys talk about stuff like that. And I think that we can, those of us who have not been game wardens or out in the field in the positions where you guys have been, can take the information that you're putting out there and apply it to people who may not have had contact with folks like you. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really, really important. So I'm going to drag my poor dispatcher friend with me back out into the trail and tell her you need to do this on the daily. It's super important.
That's great. Yeah, that's great to see you back in it and kind of you're teaching and training and kind of mentoring again, you know, in retirement in phase two. So,
right.
So kudos. That's good stuff. Before we wrap up, we deal with a lot of dispatchers, obviously, in our careers. We still stay connected to a lot of agencies, and still I keep in touch with dispatchers that save my bacon here through state parks and through the sheriff's department when I'm in California. For a new dispatcher starting out in today's world with all the challenges, any advice, any, you know, Here's a little bit of tools from my little toolbox to give you an advantage to, you know, put that fire out a little faster, not to make this mistake. What would you recommend to someone starting fresh in your profession?
I can tell you absolutely the worst part of being a dispatcher is being a trainee. It is the hardest part of the whole entire process. And so if you find it difficult now, stick with it. If this is going to be your joy in life, or if you want to call it your career, which I hope you do call it a career, stick through the training. It will be the hardest part, and it just gets easier from there on out. Secondarily, and actually more importantly, is know what your resources are and know how to recover from the job, because your job should not be your life. And you should know resources are from a job perspective and technology, but you should also, and more importantly, know what your resources are for recovery and to be able to have something to focus on that brings you joy or gives you a little peace or a little respite from the day that you just finished. And it's the shift work is hard. Your coworkers can be difficult. And there's a lot going on in that little room. And you should have something where it's an outlet for you, where you can go outside and breathe some fresh air and just be quiet for a little bit.
It's great advice. Very, very good stuff. You know, Annie, I can't say enough about dispatchers. And even as a retired lieutenant, I still get calls because they know they don't want Wayne to hear that on the news. They'd rather deliver, and sometimes it's horrible news too. But they know that they don't want you to watch the news and get this information. So they even reach out to the retired law enforcement, which is pretty epic, I think, when it comes to a job to carry that on. And I so appreciate, you know, the career of a dispatcher, because it, just like, you know, being a game warden, it's a passion, it's a talent, and those that are good at it are so valuable in supporting law enforcement, fire, ambulance, everybody that's out there. I always like using that term lifeline, because that's exactly what a dispatcher is. You will never be replaced by AI. Never.
Not gonna happen.
So, and thank you so much for coming on, you know, sharing a horrible experience, you know, that made national news, and, you know, but just to highlight, you know, the lifelines around the country. I think you're a great example of it, and I know so many more. And I'm certainly glad we can do this on the Thin Green Line and talk about that role and how important it is to all law enforcement, fire, EMS, first responders.
Yep. Yeah. Thank you very much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's been a great conversation, Annie. And thanks again. You keep crushing, stay safe, and keep running those trails.
Yes, sir.
We'll
do.
And savor every minute.
Yep. Absolutely.